Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to Order at 3:08 p.m. Tuesday, April 12, 2022. We're in the Max Grunberg Room of the Alaska Capitol, and members present from my left to my right, Representatives Tarr, Kaufman, Story, and myself, Chair Chris Tompkins, are all in the room and online. We have Representative Klayman and Representative Eastman, so six members present and a quorum to conduct business. HB 412 has been removed from today's agenda and will be added to Thursday's agenda, and we have therefore three items on today's agenda: HB 66 and the consideration and potential adoption of committee substitute for HB 66, House Bill 142 on PFD eligibility from Representative McCarty taking up amendments, and Senate Bill 182 from Senator Wilson. Before we get to the three items on today's agenda, couple of amendment deadline reminders. There's an amendment deadline for HB 226. This is pay increases for state attorneys, as well as an amendment deadline for HB 251 relating to the Board of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. For both pieces of legislation, amendments should be submitted to legal by 7 p.m. this evening and submitted to my office by 5 p.m. tomorrow. And then for House Bill 412 relating to the Permanent Fund Corp and ADA board confirmations, amendment should be submitted to legal at 5 p.m. today and submitted to my office by 5 p.m. tomorrow. And depending on time and the bill introduction, we may announce an amendment deadline for SB 182, the first hearing for which is today. So that takes us to House Bill 66. And this legislation was introduced and heard last year. And we have a robust committee substitute to present. So at this time, I may entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for HB 66, that's version O, as our working document.
Now, I'll object for discussion. Representative Eastman.
Yeah, and I'll object as well. Representative, or Mr. Stepp, if you can come forward and speak to the changes, and we'll run through this and then consider the motion.
Try to get it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jeff Stepp, staff to Rep. Chris Tompkins. Thank you for the opportunity to share the explanation of changes with the committee and introduce this new CS. You may have noticed that HB 66 version O is 10 pages and 23 sections longer than HB 66 version I. The new sections in version O correspond to sections and sometimes are identical, but not always, but correspond to sections from Senate Bill 39, short title, Ballot Custody, Tampering, Voter Registration, and Mail, by Senator Schauer. Also some sections from HB 286, Elections, Fraud, Ballots, which is a governor's bill, and some sections from HB 138, Voting by Mail, by Representative Chris Tompkins. I will point out those additions to HB 66 as I proceed through the explanation of changes in version O. Available to help with questions, Mike Mason, staff to Rep. Tuck, the sponsor of HB 66, Gail Fanumiai, director of the Division of Elections, and Noah Klein, ledge counsel from Legal Services, who drafted the bill. I'll proceed with the explanation of changes, focusing on those sections that were added from other election bills, the ones I mentioned. As a result of discussion and some debate with Representative Tuck and Senator Schauer, it's been a long, productive process, and we're glad to be where we're at today.
And I might interject and add a little bit of context for the committee. So this is a dialogue that myself and Senator Schauer and Representative Tuck have had underway since last calendar year, and variety of conversations and work drafts. And the resulting CS, which we're considering here, and that an analogous CS was adopted in Senate Judiciary, has been actively considered in Senate Judiciary right now, sort of mere policy documents, is basically, I would describe it, a best of faith attempt to sort of solve the Venn diagram political problem of setting aside some of the pipe dream policies on sort of the left and the right, if you will, that probably don't have a chance of passing the legislature, respective bodies, and focusing on the stuff that can maximize sort of consensus and get support from both sides. And so that's what the dialogue was about, and that's what the CS is aspiring to do. And I just want to share that for the committee's reference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jeff Stepp, staff to Rep. Kreis-Tompkins. Proceeding through the explanation of changes, which was in your packet and is on basis, like I said, I'll gloss over those sections that are identical to other sections from the previous version of HB 66, and we'll let you know where these sections were pulled from. So skipping ahead to Section 3, much of Section 3 of Version O corresponds to Section 3 of Version I. There's also language in there from HB 138, voting by mail, which has some new language stipulating that a voter registration applicant can designate a language preference for ballots, and election materials from the written languages required for election materials under federal law. Section 10 of Version O is new. Corresponds with the section from HB 286, Governor's Bill, requires the Division of Elections to adopt regulations for regular review and updates of the voter master voter registration file. I won't read it all verbatim. Please stop me if you have questions. Section 11 of Version O is new, and it corresponds with a section from Senate Bill 39, Senator Schauer's bill. Section 14 is a new section. This section also pulls from Senate Bill 39, which requires official ballots to include a watermark, seal, or another identifier, according to regulations issued by the Division of Elections. Section 15 is also a new section, corresponding with Senate Bill 39 and HB 286. This section has to do with ballot security and chain of custody. We've talked a lot during our deliberations about making it easier to vote and harder to cheat. And Section 15 is definitely a making it harder to cheat provision of the new CS. Section 16, requiring the Division of Elections to provide language assistance at polling places for languages required by federal law, is adopted from House Bill 138. Section 20 is new, and this wasn't pulled from any specific bill, but was a result of discussion, kind of small group discussion, talking about how to restore confidence in the elections. So this Section 20 requires the Division of Elections to conduct a risk-limiting audit of results for each state election prior to certification, and provides for that the Division of Elections shall adopt regulations for implementing and administering risk-limiting audits in consultation with experts. There was language about risk-limiting audits also in HB 138, but this language was not taken from there directly. Section 21 is a new section pulled from HB or corresponding to HB 286. Section 25 is a new section, necessary because of changes, other changes that were made in the bill. This would just require the Division of Elections to appoint at least one registration official to serve in each early voting station during early voting hours. Also provides that appointed election officials are allowed to also serve as registration officials under this section. Section 30, a new section, which is corresponds to Senate Bill 39. Section 36 is a new section corresponding to the Governor's Bill HB 286. Section 38 is a new section requiring that absentee ballots be examined to ensure the signature on the certificate is consistent with the signature in the voter's registration record. This too is pulled from HB 286, Governor's Bill. We are now up to Section 40, another new section pulled from HB 286, provides guidelines for signature verification on absentee ballot envelope certificates. Signature matching shall include signature comparison software according to regulations adopted by the Director of Elections, as well as the training of election officials on signature matching. Again, another way to make the process more secure. Section 42, a new section that pulls from HB 286 regarding online ballot tracking systems. Section 33 corresponds to SB 39, as does Section 44. We are getting near the end. Section 45 is a new section that requires the Division of Elections to only apply a voting machine or vote tally system that uses open source software technology. This is new, didn't appear in Senator Schauer's bill, but was included in consultation and discussion with Senator Schauer. Section 47, a new section, corresponds to Senate Bill 39 also, as does Section 48, Section 49, and Section 50. Section 52 addresses cybersecurity. Again, this is a result of discussion about how to make it harder to cheat. Skipping ahead to Section 57, also draws from Senate Bill 39. And then you'll see it at the end of the explanation of changes, a couple of pages on sections that were deleted or superseded, sections of version one, superseded possibly by other election bills.
Excuse me.
And that, Mr. Chairman, is about as abbreviated as we can make it.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some specific questions, but I wanted to know if you wanted to do that before or after adoption of the CS.
It's all the same to me. We can do it either way.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the collaboration, the work that y'all have done on this, and know that this is another draft for us to consider, and I appreciate that. And I think it's noteworthy for the public who have been paying attention to this just how much work that both bodies and both committee chairs and Representative Tuck have put into this, because it's been a huge effort, and a lot of the concerns that that both sides of the aisle want addressed, I think, are being addressed in this in a large part. So I do have some questions on the risk limiting audit, and I apologize for not writing down what section that was. Do we have a definition of the risk limiting audit in the bill? And can you or someone online just briefly explain what the difference in that is versus a forensic audit that a lot of the public has been asking for?
Welcome to tag team as best you two see fit, Mr. Mason and Mr. Stepp. And I also should note Representative Tuck is online as well, and I want to be sure to turn to him if he has any comments to add to the record. But Mr. Stepp and Mr. Mason.
Good afternoon. Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. So risk-limiting audits are something that the NCSL has been putting out a bunch of information about. There are a few states that have started to use this. Essentially, risk-limiting audits are a new form of post-election audits that cut down on the number of ballots that need to be audited. It's statistically based. And risk-limiting audits provide statistical confidence that an incorrect election result is not made official. It's done on an incremental audit system, so few ballots are reviewed if the margin of the election is wide, If the margin is narrow, more ballots will be reviewed up to the point that enough evidence is provided to confirm the declared election result. Last year, Kentucky and Texas created risk-limiting audit pilot programs. And once we're done here, I can share a policy brief from NCSL that's got some really detailed explanations and how it has been used in several other states. The way that our bill calls for, it would allow the Division of Elections to conduct a risk-limiting audit of each state election prior to the certification. The Division of Elections would implement this via regulations to basically implement and administer, including procedures for selecting which election results to actually audit. As part of adopting the regulations, the Division of Elections shall consult with recognized statistical experts, also equipment vendors, and municipal clerks. There's a bunch of municipal clerks around the country that have been using this. And they must also consider best practices for conducting risk-limiting election audits. And like I said, I've got a policy brief from NCSL that I can share with the committee. I believe it might have been shared last year, but I'll make sure to get that to you later today.
Thank you. Follow up.
So the division already does a random, you know, precinct audit. How is this in addition to that, and how does that change from the current practice?
It's my understanding that this would be in addition to what is already done, so it wouldn't change kind of the current practice. And there are people that know a lot more about how risk-limiting audits are used, but it's my understanding that it's essentially a statistical-based model as opposed to having to go through and look at each individual ballot. You basically choose whichever election you want to review. And like I said, if there's a few, if the margin is very wide, only a few ballots will be reviewed to make sure everything is the way it's supposed to be. If the margin is narrow, then they'll review many more ballots. And I'll get you more information about it this afternoon.
Great, thank you. I will keep my questions more broad since there's a lot to cover and I want to be respectful of everyone on the committee. I do have a couple more just high-level questions, and then I can allow for the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other one is I'll piggyback the open source software information and Mr. Stepp, you mentioned that that's something new that came from Shower's office. What I've been told is that if we utilize the open source software, that there is less of a need for forensic audits, which has been a concern that I hear a lot from my district of wanting to be able to take a deep dive. So can you talk to what the open source software and technology is a little bit and what that might do? Either one of you?
If you, Mike Mason, staff director, Chris Tuck, through the chair. If you don't mind, I might ask Gail Fenumani, the director of the Division of Elections, to weigh in on that.
Ms. Fenumani.
Hi, Gail Fenumani from the Division of Elections. I am not a qualified expert in open source software and do not feel like I can provide the committee with the question you are looking for, with the answer you're looking for.
I can speak to this a little bit because I think this is the interest in this originated foremost in the other body and my counterpart in the other body, Senate State Affairs. So I think maybe we can consult his office, although I do know some of the organizations that he has mentioned that are doing a lot of the work and policy thinking around this.
Is my understanding that this would allow a more transparent process with the ballots, seeing the results rather than having to require the division to provide that information and kind of release that? Is that kind of what it would do? Is that it would be once the election has occurred and the results are tallied with a division that all of that information would be open?
Representative Vance, I think what you're describing reflects the intent and interest of Senator Shower.
Okay. I'm just trying to get this for the public that may be watching so that we can kind of have an overview of understanding, because it's new information. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously been a concern, is all the things that we don't see that the division does, and a lot of the things that people hear on the news. So I'm just curious as to how that may impact the changes. And then one more question, and then I'll allow the others an opportunity, is Section 39 is talking about the signature verification that's so important with the mail-in ballots. Let me scroll. Section 39, on the last bullet point on the sectional analysis, it says, this addition is because the Act is making signature verification the method of verification for mail-in ballots. And when I read that, I like the idea of verifying signatures and allowing the division to have a person's signature on hand, but it's that last bullet point that concerns me. Is it the only method that identifier that a ballot can be verified? Because I'd like it more on how the division is going to verify a person is who they say they are on a ballot. Because it feels like if a signature is the only verification, we're kind of putting our eggs in one basket. Can you speak to the verification for these mail ballots?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. So, and as the chair notes, during the conversations among the various lawmakers about this, there was a need to figure out whether we wanted to leave in place the witness signature. And there were some people that wanted to remove the witness signature, others wanted there to be some sort of verification for it. So as part of getting rid of the witness signature, they included the signature verification. So everything else stays the same. It's just instead of the witness signature, you now have the signature verification, which that would be developed kind of the way the process would be developed through regulations. This was also included in the governor's bill. So I believe the director of the Division of Elections might be able to weigh in on this question as well.
Director Funumiai, any comment on this provision?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe the bill did not remove the requirement also for a voter to provide an identifier. So that would be another method of identifying the voter is actually who they say they are, in addition to the signature verification. I believe the bill only removed the requirement to have a witness signature.
Through the chair, Ms. Funumiai, can you talk to more of the signature verification and what the division would do to be able to do this verification? Because this, in my understanding, this would be a new policy for the division.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that is correct. It would be an entirely new process the division would need to implement. As part of the ballot review process, it would require the purchase of signature verification equipment and or software training, and then add that into the timeline in which the review process takes place under the normal circumstances for logging and reviewing absentee ballots. I believe the bill requires the signature verification to be completed by members of the absentee review board.
Follow up. So under the regulations that the division would be taking, would people be able to submit an electronic signature for the division to have on hand for verification?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, currently the division does capture signatures from voters when they submit voter registration applications, or so we do have signatures already captured within our voter registration system.
Follow up. So when you're doing this verifying, would this be done through automation or manual verification?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that would be something the division would need to look into. The municipality of Anchorage, as you all know, uses a signature verification process, but it is not completely automated. There still is a human element involved with verifying signatures. We would have to just look at best practices out there and see what other states are doing. And make that determination and then place those policies into, you know, the decisions into regulations.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Just quickly on close this, Mr. Mason. Also, Representative Eastman and Clayman, if either of you have questions, I would say just go ahead and text me, and I can play air traffic control for the question queue that way. And Mr. Mason, as soon as you add your comments, sort of close this line of content. I also want to go to Representative Tuck.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. I just wanted to confirm that the bill gives the director of the Division of Elections or actually requires that they provide training and signature comparison and the use of any signature comparison software that would be used to all election officials who are required to compare signatures. So they would get training and they would be able to use software that the division would be able to develop regulations to choose.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. I think this time I want to go to Representative Tuck. I don't know if that was you, Rep. Tuck. It's a little hard to discern voices or audio, but regardless of whether that was or wasn't you, if you have any comment you'd like to make, please do. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it was me. Yeah, I just want to let you know that when talking to Lieutenant Governor, he was talking about the signature verification software machines that the municipality of Anchorage has and how we would need like three or four of them for the state of Alaska. So that was one of the things that he was looking at was signature verification. And the ballots on mail-in ballots still require a signature on the outside of the ballot. And this is the machine that would be able to help verify that.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Any broader comments you'd like to make, Representative Tuck?
Yeah, and as was already pointed out by you, Mr. Chairman, that this is a collaborative effort. I'm trying to come to something where we can all walk together, recognizing the need for more security in our elections, as well as opening up our elections for more access. And they can happen simultaneously, and this is what this bill and this committee substitute hopes to do.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. And in the queue, I have Representative Clayman and Eastman, both online, and then Representative Kaufman and Representative Tarr. So we'll start with Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just note I'm more than happy to proceed with adopting the committee substitute, but I do have one question. And that's with regard to Section 43. I think this is more a question for Ms. Fenumeni. Both under the statute as it's proposed in Section 43, how would we have authority to do a vote by mail election like we're about to do for the U.S. House race? Because it looks like that section might not allow it.
Director
Fenumeni, yeah, please. Yeah, Gail Fenumeni from the Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative Clayman. I also have Tom Flynn from the Department of Law on the line, but based on my reading of this, any federal election that's conducted could not be done by mail.
And, and just to note, Mr. Flynn is online, but yes, follow up, Representative Clayman.
So under this statute, we would not be allowed to do the U.S. House candidate special election primary by mail if we passed this law, whereas we were able to do it today. Can you explain what allows us to do it today and how? And I guess this does change it.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, the current law just stated that the director may conduct an election by mail if it is held at a time other than when the general party primary or municipal election is held. That is how we had statutory authorization to conduct the special primary election by mail this time.
And Representative Clayman, I might just make a comment, especially being the sponsor of vote by mail legislation. I'm obviously not opposed in any way to having the option for by mail elections. I think the language in this bill sort of reflects the nexus of offices and thinking, although I think given recent developments in Alaska, the utility of having that option to conduct a by mail election in unusual or extenuating circumstances has been made quite clear. So this might be something that the committee and also the sponsor in the Senate may be worth another conversation as well, but just a little bit of context there. Representative Kleeman, did you have another question?
Just a brief comment that I do think there's reasons to be allowed to have some elections by mail. I'd note that subsection 5 of section 43 that references a party primary actually seems to be antiquated as well, because under the ranked choice voting and the open primary there, we no longer have party primaries. But those concerns are not a reason to not adopt the CSO.
Thank you, Representative Kleeman. And in terms of adopting the CSO, I think what I'll do is go through the course of the committee and allow lines of questions, and then maybe at that time we can kind of call the question on adoption of the CS. Obviously, we're going to dig into this. it's a robust policy document in future hearings. But next in the queue, we have Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. My question deals back with the risk-limiting audits. Looking at that section, I want to know, so currently, you know, the division, the Senate Governor's Office has, you know, authority to conduct some review of things either before or after an election. This risk-limiting audit, does it have the effect of restricting the types of audits that can currently be performed based on these statistical methods that are being required to be used?
Through the chair, Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. It is my understanding that this does not preclude any of the current methods of auditing election results. It just adds one more tool to the toolbox for the Division of Elections.
I'll also add on the subject of risk-limiting audits, RLAs. When I was first the chair of this committee back in 2017, I held a hearing on election security before it was so in vogue in present day. And because it's always been an area of interest to me, although I maybe have approached it through a slightly different lens than it seems to be seen in present day. And RLAs came up in that hearing as a recommended best practice from a variety of authorities. And just given this has surfaced twice in committee questions, I think what we could very easily do is bring in some election security experts to kind of give us, you know, auditing and risk limiting audit 101, because it was presented then back in that 2017 election security hearing as sort of a gold standard for election integrity and corroborating results. And so I was just going to flag that that's something that we can bring back to the committee for a deeper dive, as well as the open source voting per your question, Representative Vance. Back to you, Representative Eastman, for any additional questions.
Thank you, and follow up to the chair. So I'm looking at page 10, line 13, same section, and it's basically the way I'm reading it. It's saying the risk-limiting audit is only useful and will only be used if it's believed that the recount, you know, will obtain a specific result. In this case, the you're expecting that the recount is going to change the outcome of the election. So that's what triggers your ability to do a risk-limiting audit. Am I reading that correctly?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. I don't believe so. It is my understanding that the way this reads is that after each election, but before certification, the ballot counting, or excuse me, the director shall conduct a risk-limiting audit of selected election results. The regulations will be developed that will choose which election results they can take a look at. But this basically is required under the bill.
And follow up. And is there a drafter or someone from Ledge Legal available to speak to that particular sentence?
Yes, Noah Klein. Mr. Klein, if you're with us, can you speak to that particular sentence?
Through the chair, this is Noah Klein to Representative Eastman. Could you repeat your question? I just want to make sure I'm clear on what you're asking.
So I'm looking at the line that begins, the audit must be designed using statistical methods to limit the risk of certification of an election result that is inconsistent with the result that will be obtained by conducting a recount. And so it seems to me that we're tying the audit and the implementation of the audit based on risk that either there will or won't be a change to the result that would be obtained by a recount. So it seems like if a recount is going to have the same result as the original count, then that's kind of what we're tying this to. Could you speak to that, please?
Through the chair, to Representative Eastman, this is Noah Klein with Legislative Legal. I'm not an expert in risk-limiting audits, but the way that I read the second sentence in that paragraph in relation to the first sentence in that paragraph and then also the next subsection is not that whether or not the audit occurs is limiting to the risk, but just how the audit is conducted is focused on limiting the risk of certification in a way that would be inconsistent. So it's not that the audit is dependent on that risk, but it's just that's how the audit itself is conducted.
And
Paul,
thank you. Yes, and on that, the purpose basically of the audit, since we're narrowing the scope in that sentence to the recount result or an anticipated recount result if a recount were to go forward, it seemed to me that the recount is sort of what we're targeting. We're conducting a risk-limiting audit to save us from taking that step of a recount, because if we took that step of a recount, it would yield a different result. And so we're going to do the audit first, and perhaps we are going to gather some information that's going to save us from having to do the recount. My concern in that is that if the recount is going to yield a different result or the same result, whatever it is, the risk-limiting audit is going to have nothing to do with whether or not, the ballots themselves are correct or legal or lawful or fraudulent or anything like that, because we're tying it to the recount. So if we're doing a recount, we're just going to go through and count the same ballots over again. And so if we think that counting the same ballots over again is going to yield the same result, well, then there's not really much need for an audit. We're going to have it. Yes, in the first part, we're going to have it. But the purpose of the audit seems to be very much narrowed in scope to the results of a recount. So that's the concern that I want to voice.
Noted. Thank you, Representative Eastman. We can tease that apart in future hearings. I'm not sure that's the intent, but if that's the construction of the current draft, we can certainly revisit that. Any
Excellent.
Additional questions, Representative Eastman?
Just the other question I had for now is, what is the impact? I just wanted to speak more specifically. What is the impact of passage of this bill on retention of election records?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. I would have to spend a few moments and find it, but I think the only significant change is that there is language in here for the retention of all ballots for, off the top of my head, is 22 months. Does that sound right? I think that that is what is in the bill. That's the only change that I can think of.
Follow up. And so we're going to 22 months. What is the current standard for retention of records that we're now going to 22 months?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. I might ask the director of the Division of Elections to weigh that, to answer that one.
Director Funumiai.
Kale Funumiai, Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative Eastman. Current state of Alaska Division of Elections records retention schedule does require all ballots to be retained for 22 months and other election materials to be retained for a period of 4 years post-certification.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, through the chair. And so what's the motivation for going in the case of the documents that we're currently requiring to be maintained for 4 years, bringing that down to 22 months if that's what we're doing in the bill?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. That was language that was taken directly out of, I believe, Senator Showers, SB 39, through the process of working with the other offices.
And Representative Eastman, that's my recollection as well. I don't think there's any particular intent from my office given Mr. Mason's comment, Representative Tuck's office in that regard, one way or the other.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman, it's all right if we move next to the queue. I
think those are my questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rep. Eastman, and over to you, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. through the chair to Mr. Mason, I noticed that there's many sections that are amending Section 9, 26, 27, 31, et cetera. Many sections here where the change is to rename absentee voting stations as early voting stations. And I'm just wondering, is that part of a larger move to not even consider it absentee, but just consider that we're doing early voting if we're not going to be there on election day?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, and I will ask Rep. Tuck to weigh in on this since he is way more familiar with this than I am. But it's my understanding there has been confusion across much of Alaska, especially outside of the more urban areas where there are Division of Elections offices, between what is early voting and what is absentee in-person voting. For instance, when I lived in Dillingham, you could not early vote, even though that's what people thought they were doing. Instead, they were casting an absentee in-person ballot. What the intent of House Bill 66 is, the new CS, is to clarify that and basically call all of those stations early voting stations, despite the fact that you're casting an actual in-person absentee ballot. Instead of when you go to an early voting station, say in Anchorage, where you're actually casting a different ballot, you're not doing it absentee in person, you're casting an actual early vote. It's my understanding. And I would ask Rep. Tuck to weigh in here since he has way more expertise on this than I do.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that Mike pretty much captured it. What we had going on, especially in the 2016 election, is there was times when people were turned away from voting early in rural areas of Alaska because they're doing an in-person absentee ballot. It's kind of an oxymoron, you know, which is it? Are you in person or are you absent? But people were turned away saying, no, you have to be absent to be able to do a early voting, in this case, in-person absentee. There is confusion. So to eliminate the confusion, we are suggesting that it's all be called early voting. Truly, the only place that we have early voting is, I believe, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, because we have election headquarters set up to be able to take early voting. Outside of that, to vote earlier than election day, it's in-person absentee, which creates confusion. So we're just trying to eliminate the confusion. I don't think people are really concerned about how their vote is going to be counted as long as their vote is counted. And the distinction is how the ballot's being handled, because there is no truly election early voting places in rural Alaska, that this is the only way to do that. This just cleans it all up. So you'll find that in many different sections because it's making all those changes across all our statutes.
Yeah, and Representative Crawford, my understanding is it's basically sort of a confusion reduction thing. But yeah, Representative
Thanks, Crawford. But I'm still confused.
Go ahead and take another whack at a question.
So what will the population of potential ballots be? So there's early in person. So I guess what's the palette of available ballots that we're going to have? Thank you.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. So it's my understanding, and I might ask the director of the Division of Elections to make sure I'm not getting this wrong, that the actual ballots don't change. It's the name of what you're doing that changes. So when you show up in a remote area to early vote, you're actually still casting the absentee in person, the absentee ballot. You're just doing it in person. The bill authorizes the director of the Division of Elections to basically allow, say, municipal clerks or other people, they are authorized to witness that and go through the process of letting you submit an absentee in-person vote. So the actual ballots that are available don't change. It's just the name of what you're doing that changes, is my understanding.
Director Fenumia, is that accurate for your reading of the bill?
Hi, Gail Fenumia from the division. Through the chair, Representative Kaufman. Early voting and absentee in-person voting are two very distinct processes in the Division of Elections operations. True, everybody votes early if it's before Election Day. The early voting locations are at our 5 regional elections office. And what happens when you go to early vote is you present your identification to the election official. They will verify that your Alaska residence address is still as reflected in the state's voter registration system. And the voter's eligibility is determined right then and there. There's no need for them to complete an absentee in-person open affidavit envelope. So they sign the voter certificate, vote their ballot, and no further review of that voter's eligibility is needed. There are some other locations that provide that service as well. I don't remember them right off the top of my head. But absentee in-person voting takes place typically outside of the regional elections offices, and those usually are single-site voting locations. And the voter has to provide identification to the voter, but they have to complete a ballot envelope with their name, their residence address, their identifier. It has to be signed, and then the election official signs as well. And then those ballots go back to the division and are logged by staff, and then the voter eligibility is determined at that time to ensure that the voter was eligible to cast the ballot for that specific house district. So there are two very distinct processes, and that is the reason that originally they were named in this fashion. True, it may all be early, because anything prior to Election Day is early, but there are significant procedural differences in how both of those are processed and conducted.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Follow up through the chair, Ms. Fenumia. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, so structurally, what will the difference be? So you're saying that there's a certificate, a registration certificate on the absentee ballot, but on the what's being referred to as an early vote ballot, there's not one on those. So it's a different design of the envelope?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, when you go to early vote in a regional election office, there's no envelope whatsoever. A piece of paper prints out with your voter information on it and a certificate that you sign right then and there. And your eligibility to cast that ballot has already been verified by that election official there at the early voting location. And you're done. So anybody outside of that goes through the process of completing that other envelope that I described earlier, which then goes back to the regional elections offices and is processed by staff, and then the absentee review boards will review those to determine voter eligibility.
Follow up. And I guess that's because in the absentee voting process, there's not staff or the capability to verify the voting registration of the people?
Through the chair, Representative Coffin, that is correct. The early voting locations have access to the statewide voter registration database. These outlying absentee voting locations do not have that access, and so therefore the voter eligibility needs to be determined when those ballots are returned to the division.
Thank you. Follow-up, one more.
Follow-up.
And so are we leaving anybody behind if we were to rename voting stations from absentee voting stations to early voting stations? Is that going to create any confusion?
Through the chair, Representative Coffin, I don't believe you're leaving anybody behind. I've never actually been aware of the confusion by voters. It's an internal, you know, this is how the division differentiates what processes are done at what locations. So no voters will be, it won't change for any voters in the method in which they vote if you choose to go with this change.
I can maybe comment on this a little bit. So, I mean, it's purely a semantic change. I, most of the time, cast an early in-person absentee vote. Well, scratch the early part. I cast an absentee in-person vote at Sitka City Hall most elections before Election Day, which under passage of the CS would then be known as an early voting station. But I've had conversations with people in Sitka when they go to cast their early vote, which is technically an absentee in-person vote at Sitka City Hall. You know, per Director Funumiai's testimony, that ballot won't actually be counted early. It will be, you know, sent to Juno and they'll have to do all the verification and it gets counted with all the other absentee ballots. But it kind of creates some like head spinning because it's kind of an oxymoron, an in-person absentee ballot. But all Sitka City Hall in future elections of the CS passes will just be known as an early voting station. Even though on the back end, on the ballot counting end of things, it's not a true early voting station the way the five DOE offices are, in which those ballots are, anyway. But as far as the voter goes, nothing is changing except the name. But they're on the back end, there are these two different sort of procedural paths on how the ballots are counted.
Thank you. Shouldn't we just call them voting stations?
Good work. Yeah. I think it's primarily the absentee in-person sort of oxymoron that is being targeted here. Any additional questions, Representative Kaufman?
Not yet. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Tarr next in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions here. I just want to make sure, number one, I understand once we get to Section 1520.221 and then 222, we're only talking about absentee ballots is one thing I want to confirm, and I'm pretty certain around that. But then question number one is on the ballot tracking system, is the intent that the tracking system would only be available for individuals who choose to vote absentee? Is question number one.
I'm Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. Yes, the ballot tracking with the intelligent mail barcodes and all of that would only apply to essentially the absentee voting system. There would not be necessary when you show up at a polling place and cast an in-person vote. While the ballot, there are other provisions in here for like watermarks on ballots and that kind of thing, but like the actual tracking and being able to tell you where your ballot is, that would apply to the absentee system.
Okay. Thank you, if I might continue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that makes a lot of sense. That's how Anchorage is doing it now. But one thing I've noticed is in Anchorage, for example, there's starting to be a lot of confusion around local elections and statewide elections. And people are thinking that their municipal ballots that they got in the mail are their statewide ballots. And it just sort of concerns me that as these systems continually evolve and we aren't the sort of the same in each, that there's the potential for confusion around that. So that's, you know, one thing I'm just sort of thinking about and as a reaction to this of uniformity, you know, as being something that, you know, just helps build confidence. And so I want to think about that a little bit more. And then in the section on curing ballots, the line that has me concerned on page 19 is where it's page 19, line 17, in that sentence where it says, you know, it goes on for the process, but then it starts, the director shall immediately make a reasonable effort to contact the voter. Explain the ballot deficiency, explain how the deficiency may be cured, and inform the voter of the deadline to cure the ballot. And then, you know, it goes on, the director shall within 48 hours, but, you know, not more than 2 days after for these other parts. It just seems to me this shall immediately make a reasonable effort is something that could be challenged in terms of, you know, the timeline. And I wondered if you considered putting more direction on, you know, the time frame in which these things need to happen, just so there's, you know, kind of the clear understanding of within, you know, whatever, 24 hours, 48 hours, how that would work. So I guess I would love to hear from the bill sponsors and then from the director if possible.
Yeah, and I just know ballot curing is one of these policy areas where there's been sort of multi Venn diagram overlap, and Representative Shragi has a bill, Senator Schauer had that provision. But Mr. Mason, Mr. Stepp, and then we can also hear from Director Panunyai.
Yeah, jumping in real quick. This is Jeff Stepp, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. And that's precisely what I was going to say. There are different ballot cure provisions in several different bills. And I think at the end of the day, the decision with the drafting language here was to put the ball in the director's court to decide on the most appropriate timeline in which to respond.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. If you note in the bill, so it allows the director to basically contact the voter through different means than just sending a deficiency notice through the mail, which it still requires. That's the director shall within 48 hours, but in no event later than 2 days after the election day, send a notice of deficiency by first class non-forwardable mail to the address indicated on the voter's registration. But it also allows to send it via electronic mail, which can be done very quickly, or it allows, if you go down to the, it would be lines 23 through 25 on that same page, page 19, if the voter has provided a telephone number, the director shall attempt to notify the voter of the deficiency by telephone call or text message or to the voter's telephone number. So essentially, as they've said, is we're giving the division great latitude to use kind of the way people communicate now, via text, via phone calls, or via email, and then you still have to do the mail deficiency notice.
And Director Funumiai, on the ballot curing question.
And Mr. Chairman, it's the shall immediately make a reasonable effort. So sort of shall immediately, very clear, but then reasonable effort, not so clear. And so I just, like, the combination is what I wonder if I'm the only one that sort of reads that as not being as clear as it could be.
Any comment, Director Funumiai?
Gail Funumiai, through the chair, Representative Tarr. I don't have a comment on that, except to me, shall immediate means like right now, but reasonable effort does seem a little unclear. And I don't know if there's a legal definition of reasonable effort or not, but that's it. Thanks.
Free follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you so much. And this is a really important one to me because it tends to be voters in my area, and that when we look, you know, the ballots that get rejected tend to be more in my area and with folks with English as a second language and some of the sort of communication barriers that sometimes mean information isn't transferred quite as easily as we might think it is. You know, for me, reading the director shall immediately, I agree with you, that's pretty specific, but the reasonable effort, would you, you know, be tracking that, for example? I mean, would the division have some form that, you know, makes note that you sent an email at such and such time, that you placed a phone call at such and such time? Because then if the voter challenged it, and, you know, it seems worth this conversation, given that we have had at least two elections I can think of in the last 20 years where it was a tie and one was won by a single vote. So it's those circumstances where it's, you know, this may, people may, you know, be a lot more picky about the exact wording. So would you have some kind of proof that you, you know, made the quote unquote reasonable attempt, reasonable effort, pardon me?
Through the chair, Gail Fanumi, through the chair, Representative Tarr, I mean, I would imagine, I honestly have not thought this through in great detail, but I would imagine that the division would have to develop some kind of tracking mechanism, who we contacted, how and when, in order to fulfill this section of the statute if it was passed.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Tarr?
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Okay. And Representative Story, over to you.
Thank you, Chair Price-Tompkins. So on page 1, line 10, for your voter qualifications, you need to register at least 30 days just before the election. And then on page 2, then it also says if applying within 30 days before an election. So it's saying have to apply at least 30 days before, but then there's also allows for within 30. So we're expanding that. And then there's a lot of more additional, an affidavit. Adds a lot of language. And is that because that's thought to have higher scrutiny inside the new window of time? Just questions about that.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. So this is what people call same-day voter registration, even though it is the 30-day window before an election, which was very important to I know the bill sponsor, to Representative Tuck and to others. The way it works, and I might have the director of the Division of Elections make sure I'm not getting this wrong, is that a person that is properly registered in the 30 days beyond or before the election, they can walk in anywhere, or not anywhere, they can go to their polling place and cast a regular ballot. If you take advantage of the same day voter registration or that window of 30 days, you can vote the special needs or the absentee in person or the question ballots, but you cannot vote the regular ballot. That's because those other forms of the ballots are reviewed and your residency is checked and all of that kind of thing. Whereas if I walk into a ballot, into a voting place, and I get to cast that ballot, that once it's in the machine, it's gone. You can never take that ballot back. Whereas in that 30-day window, all of the ballots that are cast by people that take advantage of that would have to be reviewed by the Division of Elections to make sure that they are properly cast.
Follow
up. So in many areas, we are adding, work for the division. And I am wondering if you could just remind me what the fiscal note is for these added. I'm looking right now.
Mike Mason's staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. So the actual fiscal note that we have is not going to be representative of this bill. This bill is greatly expanded. And if you give me one moment, I can track down. There it is. So essentially, this is the fiscal note that dates back to this would be the 6th of January. So this is to the previous version, version I of House Bill 66. So the fiscal impact of this legislation cannot be determined because the proposed processes need to be fully evaluated in conjunction with the division's current procedures to determine what is additional and what is duplicative. New processes will need to be integrated, and that will would drive costs. There will be costs associated with the return postage for the by-mail ballots. Using a two-year election cycle, average of return by-mail ballots for 2018 and 2020 of 84,418, the estimated cost would be $66,600. Reprinting of absentee by-mail, absentee in-person, special needs, and question ballot envelopes estimated at $138,600. Electronic signature system, voter registration, and election management system programming enhancements for permanent absentee voters and others. Hiring of temporary staff to manage the proposed ballot cure process and automated interactive voice response systems for voters to check status of their absentee ballot. So the total cost, or the cost of that, would be $57,300. And I think it totals, no, it does not. My math is horrible, but we could total those three up, and that would be the current fiscal note. But this is not even close to reflective of what this current CS would do.
Follow up. Thank you. And I guess one of my questions at some point would just be, as the Division of Elections looks at this more, and I know Director Fanumiai said that some parts she wasn't sure how the, and I don't want to speak for you, sorry, through the chair. I was just wondering if there's anything we should be really aware of, any provisions that have been presented that might cause pause.
Director Fanumiai.
Through the chair, Gail Fidumia, through the chair, Representative Story. It's a big bill, and the division has, we have not had the opportunity to go through it in great detail to determine that. There are a lot of changes. There are some sections in this bill talking about things that the division does currently do, such as what Mr. Mason was mentioning earlier. Any voter who's not on a precinct register when you vote to vote on election day has to go to question ballot. Whether you're registered or not registered. But so there is some duplicative items in the proposed legislation that we already do, but then there are also some really big things, you know, signature verification, the potential of purchasing new voting equipment and software, reprinting all of the division's forms as it relates to not having to have a witness anymore. It would be a lot of work to take on, but in an off election year, there really hasn't been one of those lately. But you know, the division would do everything in their power to make sure that they can implement the law as passed.
One more follow-up, please.
Representative Story.
I got through the chair. Thank you for that. Seems reasonable and. I was wondering, curing is very important to me too, and to constituents. And in this bill, I'm kind of curious, what are the main reasons why people's ballots were thrown out in past elections? And is there something we should be doing in this bill to make sure that is corrected?
Through the chair, Representative Story, Gail Fanumiai from the division. No witness was a big factor, I believe. Voters forgetting to sign their envelope or not providing an identifier as well. Those are the three main issues. Obviously, if a ballot is postmarked after Election Day, but those are the three main reasons for rejection that come to mind.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've gone all the way around the horn. We'll have hearings to dive deeper into any and all sections, including some of the areas that have been raised in questions and consideration of the CS adoption motion. So with that, I'm going to remove my objection. Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection on the motion to adopt the CS?
Yes, I'll maintain my objection. Appreciate the efforts, but I think there's more still to be had as far as discussion on some of these items before I think we're ready for amendments in touch.
Well, as a point of clarity, we're not doing amendments today, and the point of adopting the CS would be to have discussion, but the objection is noted. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Clayman.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Yes. And by a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay, version /O is adopted for House Bill 66. We'll set the legislation aside. We'll have it back for a deeper dive in a future hearing. Thank you very much, Mr. Stepp and Mr. Mason, Director Funumiai, and others with the administration available for questions. And thank you, big thanks to Noah Klein and Legislative Legal for that work draft. So this takes us to the next item on today's agenda, House Bill 142. And coming in the door is Representative McCarty. We have, I think, upwards of 15 amendments. It might not be exactly that number, but we have 15 work order numbers. My goal is to get through all of these, ideally, today. So I might encourage a more economical approach, but I will keep an eye on the clock and assess time management as you go. I'm ready to go past 5 o'clock, but not invade the evening too much. So with that, Representative McCarty, any opening remarks you'd like to make?
Thank you, Chair and Committee. Representative Ken McCarty from District 13, Eagle River Chugach, Jay Bear. And with seeing all these amendments, I'm excited about your strong interest in House Bill 142 and making it right for Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCarty. And we don't have anyone from PFD Division online, so I'm going to take a quick at ease. Going back on the record, and we have PFD Division online now. I'm generally going to go through amendments in the order of the work draft numbers, although Representative Eastman had a request to go in a non-chronological number, so I will cue them in that order. It'll be 10, 11, 9, 12, 13, 14, 15, the back end of the stack. But starting with the first work order number, I'm going to go ahead and move amendment number 1, which is work order number W.1.
Object for discussion?
And for presentation, I'm just going to go directly to the PFD division for W.1, which is, this is an amendment drafted in communication with the division. Director McKinnon, would you be able to speak to amendment W.1, amendment number 1?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the State Affairs Committee. Anna McKinnon, the Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, line 7, there's a new section of the bill that is inserted. And basically, Mr. Chairman, what this does is it allows students who accidentally vote out of state to be able to correct that mistake and still qualify for a permanent fund dividend.
Questions from the committee on amendment number 1?
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So if a student is a resident of Alaska, which is part of what makes them eligible for a dividend, and they are voting in another state, I do believe that would be a crime in that other state. Maybe not in our state, but certainly in that other state. why would we be wanting that student to be eligible as if they were a resident of our state if they're voting in another state?
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Yes, Mr. McKinnon.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we have freshmen specifically and sophomores that, depending on campus activity, are caught up in the excitement to register to vote, usually around a general election, and they do not know that registering to vote is a severing action for their permanent fund dividend. And so the division sees multiple students each year that did not intend or do not understand that voting in another state has a consequence to eliminate their possibility of having a dividend. And so they want to correct that. They usually come back to Alaska when they can, as allowable on that education education absence, and then they register to vote in the state of Alaska. So it was never their intent to be a resident somewhere else.
Follow up. So I'm trying to figure out why this is special and different than any other type of activity where someone would be taking an action that they can only lawfully take if they are a resident of another state. I mean, if Ted Cruz is the senator that you're voting for on your ballot, I mean, that's great, but he doesn't represent Alaska, and then you cast that ballot. Now you've voted in another state. I mean, is that fundamentally different than, getting a fishing license in another state because you happen to go to school in that state and you're getting the resident, fishing license, which I think also is problematic when you come back and try and apply for a dividend in our state, correct?
Through the chair, Director McKinnon, Representative Eastman, this is a policy decision for the legislature. We have multiple parents and students that feel disenfranchised because a student does not recognize that during an election cycle that they register to vote, and they have brought to the division that they believe that is unfair, and these students are working through appeals every year to advocate for why they are still Alaska residents.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I think that makes a very great case for the fact that we have, an education issue in terms of educating Alaska residents, particularly college students, apparently Alaska voters that are not Alaska voters. I don't see that the solution here is to say, okay, you're fine. You may have accidentally committed a crime in another state, but, we'll treat you as though you're still a resident here. It seems to me it's a valid concern, and the concern should be addressed through education efforts to parents and students, maybe universities, et cetera, so that, that we minimize that happening in the future.
Noted. Other questions, Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. Just trying to get an understanding of the exact language that's here in this amendment, page 2. I'm just piggybacking on the questions that Representative Eastman had. In section G, it talks about the individual who's absent from the state for a reason permitted under A1 or 2 of the section, but who the department determines is ineligible because the individual voted or registered to vote outside the state, regains eligibility for a permanent fund dividend if. So does that mean that the division could determine if they voted in another state in 2020, would the division be able to determine that they're still eligible for their 21 dividend, or would they lose the eligibility for the 21, but then they could regain the eligibility for 22?
Through the chair, Director McKinnon here, to Representative Vance. Currently under the bill, there is an effective date that would make your example not work. So the effective date on this bill on line 23 is for the dividend qualifying year of 2023, which means that dividend year that we started collecting applications would be in 2024. But your point is well taken, so let me try. First, under one and two, item number one is for someone out of state receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. On item number two, it's if you're out of state receiving vocational, professional, or other specific education on a full-time basis for which, as determined by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, a comparable program is not reasonably available in the state. So then I'm moving on to the amendment, page 2, line 5, where you asked, regains eligibility. Yes, that would be the remedy if they did 1, 2, and 3, that then the permanent fund dividend division, if that was the only reason that they were denied a dividend, could have a remedy to fix making that action.
Follow up. So in the year that they voted in another state, they would lose their eligibility for that year's dividend? Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions on amendment number one?
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I see that the remedy in section 4 for someone who, you know, has voted in another state includes on line 10, page 2 of the amendment, registering to vote in this state. And I'm just wondering if we might be setting folks up for another kind of problem. If they just voted in, say, Oklahoma, and now they're registering to vote in Alaska for the same election, basically inviting them to, vote twice in the same election, I'm a little concerned about that. Is there a way we can, make sure they're not, being encouraged to vote twice in the same election, for example?
Director McKinnon here. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that would never be the case. The timing on an election is very different than the application period. The timing on the elections that are most affected by this are in November of a presidential election, but that is the norm that we see this error by the students. We wouldn't find out about that until they filed for the following year's dividend through the application on January 1st through March 31st. And we would be working to see if there were other reasons why that student would not qualify. But this would be an error, an item that shows up on their application as a reason to deny their dividend.
Follow up.
So
I guess this is to the maker of the amendment. I understand the rationale, and I understand that we as the state wouldn't necessarily know that, they had voted another election until, long after they had done so. But that's not the way the amendment reads. The amendment reads, once they voted in the other, state, and then they re-register to vote in this state, which could be the day after. I mean, if they did register to vote in Alaska the day after voting in Oklahoma, then the language of the amendment would say that, all right, that's part of their becoming eligible again. I'm just wondering if maybe we can, have a caveat in there perhaps so that, we're talking about registering to vote after that election period or campaign cycle or what have you, because I just see that, while we're trying to do a good thing here, we might be inviting, if not encouraging, abuse, because that the amendment doesn't seem to read the way that we're trying to intend it to read.
So as the sponsor of Amendment Number 1 and recognizing it's now 4:35, I think I want to move away from amendments at 5 o'clock. I do want to work through some of these amendments today. And I think there's maybe a couple of questions about this amendment. I'm going to set amendment number one aside so we can continue to work through the stack and revisit it in what will be a future hearing. Representative Kaufman on this subject.
Thank you. Through the chair to the committee, I wonder if maybe the fix is not in the previous bill 66 that we were hearing. So it may be that the cure to these questions are actually in 66.
Mm-hmm. Noted. Okay, well, with amendment number one aside, amendment number two, W.2, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move amendment number two.
I'll object.
Object. There's an objection from Representative Tarr, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, the amendment here comes from the concern that, you know, while we have, you know, created a long list of exemptions, we haven't taken into account those who are, you know, temporarily out of state, you know, working full time on a charitable program, whether that's a religious missions trip or whether that, you know, working for an NGO, say somebody wanted to go to Ukraine, for example, and help with the conflict there in some way. You know, if they're working for the Peace Corps, we recognize that service and they're eligible. And if they're in the military, we recognize that service, they're eligible. But there's, you know, other Alaskans that have, you know, had the unfortunate experience of going and trying to do a good thing, you know, part of their church or other program. And then they're told that because, you know, it didn't qualify under those exemptions, that they're no longer eligible for their dividend. So I just wanted to dress that up in the language and make sure that those types of service are also being encouraged by our statute.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative McCarty, any comment on amendment number two?
Thank you, through the chair. I think amendment number two with religious and charitable programs opens up quite a bit of discussion of what that constitutes. I remember a long time ago, set up a nonprofit organization dealing with religious purposes. And what came to mind in that process was the guidelines or the parameters that the federal government has for 501c3. And the takeaway is if you truly believe in that, then they give you that, you know, category of that charitable or religious. So if I am a worshiper of candles and I truly believe in it, I could potentially get a 501c3 for that. And I'm like, wow. Yeah. So you really have to believe in what you have down there. Now, with that said, is that I think this opens up to a lot of different things. And I think that's a dangerous path to go down.
Director McKinnon, any comment on amendment number two?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a policy decision for the legislature. Those are my comments.
Representative Vance, a question?
Yes. I have a question for Representative Eastman, the maker of the amendment. How would you define a religious or charitable program as written in your amendment?
You know, I would invite the division to, by regulation, proffer a definition that was appropriate. You know, if I was writing it, I think I would be looking at some of the federal definitions for tax status of an organization, so forth. You know, organizations that regularly send individuals overseas or out of Alaska for periods of service. You know, I think the candles option probably wouldn't qualify in that type of option.
Representative Tarr, do you maintain the objection?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Any wrap-up comments, Representative Eastman?
No, I wanted to bring up the topic because I know it does come up on occasion, and it's something we haven't put together any guidelines on, but it seems like that's an area where we're lacking, and it's a little bit of a disparity because we've got, you know, some very specific exemptions for, you know, like the Peace Corps, for example. But if it's not the Peace Corps, you could be doing the same work with a recognized charitable organization or church, and yet, you know, there's a disparity there.
With objection maintained on amendment number 2W.2, will the clerk please read the roll on adoption of amendment number 2?
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Carr.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Clayman.
No.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative Hoffman.
Yes.
Chair Price Hoffman.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3 yeas, 4 nays, amendment number 2 fails to be adopted. That takes us to amendment number 3. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move amendment 3.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Probably the least controversial of the amendments today. So for reasons that I was never able to quite fully understand, we put in statute that, if you're going to qualify under this education exemption, that it needs to be a program determined by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, you know, not to have a similar program in the state kind of a thing. I contacted the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and it is their policy 100% of the time to make no determination. They don't see this as part of their mission, and so I don't believe they ever have made that determination. You know, when you have a student that contacts them and asks for that determination, they say, sorry, we don't do that. And it would seem that we could save students and the commission those waits and time interactions by removing that requirement. Since, unfortunately, I don't think the legislature ever got buy-in from the commission on giving them this role.
Director McKinnon, I have a question. Is what was just said correct so far as your knowledge in terms of ABCPE's interest or willingness in playing that sort of adjudicatory role?
Mr. Chairman, I have no knowledge of that statement at all. It is in state statute.
Representative Story, as a member of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, do you have any insight for us?
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I do not know the answer to that question, but I would think we could get it from Senate Eford, the executive director. But I do know that the role of why the commission was probably put here is their job is consumer protection for students to make sure that any other program we offer in the state, that they have if the program disbands, that they have a buyback or a payback for the student or a way to let them graduate from the program that they chose, so they make sure that it's a solvent organization, amongst other things, is the role of the commission when they look at other education institutes. So it's consumer protection. And so I don't know if their role is to look at that other institution and check out some of those policies to make sure they are a solvent and a worthwhile organization to put your money in for an education. So I would say talking to the director. Possibly.
Yeah, I feel similarly. I'm not necessarily opposed to this amendment, but I would want to hear from ACPE directly. Sorry, Representative Eastman, did you have a comment?
I was just going to suggest that we've already set aside one of the amendments. Maybe we could set this amendment aside as well and then get an opportunity for the director or representative from the commission to come and help us better understand where they're at on this.
That sounds great to me. And Representative Eastman, if you have the opportunity to, perhaps interact with the commission in writing or sort of share anything the committee could consider in advance of the next hearing, that would be helpful. But yes, I agree. Having them present at the hearing would also be Terrific.
So yeah, I did ask for some things in writing on this, and it was part of their policy last time, a little while back, that they said no, they don't want anything in writing. They really just don't want to have anything to do with it. So the only thing I could get was an answer from over the phone. But I'm sure the director or someone else could probably testify.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Representative Eastman. That sounds good. And I think my office will work to see if we can have ACPE made available. So with amendment number 3 set aside, that takes us to amendment number 4, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move amendment 4.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And currently we have sort of an older definition of uniform service and statute. What I'm trying to do is make sure that we capture each of the different types of service under that category. I'm not talking, just the federal side. Obviously, that's most of it. But I have two versions of this amendment, and I also saw Representative Story had another one. What I'm hoping for in whatever amendment that we can agree on is that we include each of the different, government uniforms that are recognized as public service, whether you're in Space Force, even though a lot of folks aren't necessarily familiar with that, or whether you're in the public health services, I think those should all be recognized. They all, whether you're in the Alaska National Guard or the Space Force, there's an expectation in all those situations where you could be deployed. Public health service, same thing. You could be deployed for a year or more, which would, under certain circumstances, make you ineligible for a dividend. But I think it should be the policy of our state not to, cause that service to make someone no longer eligible.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I speak strongly in favor of this amendment. Representative Eastman is right. I have an amendment along this lines later on, and I think that this is a clearer version than the language that I have in my amendment. But I think it's really important that we recognize, long overdue, our two NOAA Commissioned Officers Corps and the United States Public Health Service Commission Corps. They are actually a higher ranking member of their branch than of the armed services, which is not important. They're all very important. But they serve our country on long deployments in other places. And I think we have 15 Alaska residents in the NOAA Commission Corps, and it is more in the Public Health Service. I had that number, but now I cannot find it. But it's so I'd like to get that. I want to say 200, but
231.
Oh, thank you. but I think they really put their life on the line in many places. And are really doing a good service in public health, and NOAA, they often fly into hurricanes. They have dive operations. They manage research projects, things that are really important. And of course, we all know how public health is so important. And anyway, so I could speak longer on that, but I think it's important to include them.
So I have a question for, I guess, Representative Story or Representative Eastman. My mother was in the Commissioned Corps for the Public Health Services. She did her residency in Maine. Let's just say Maine had a permanent fund dividend program. She worked for the Indian Health Service in Sitka, coming out of residency, and worked 20-plus years. And effectively, Sitka was the intent to be her home as soon as she took that position as a doctor in Sitka and served in the Commission Corps for all those years. There was never any real tether to Maine. So if Maine had a permanent fund dividend program under adoption of this amendment, would she have been able to claim a Maine permanent fund dividend for the entirety of her working career?
So the answer to that would be no under my intent, because I'm talking about deployments and we're not talking about someone's, you know, permanent, you know, station, if you will. So if you are deployed, you know, if you're a resident of one state and you're on a deployment, and public health service, there's individuals who can be deployed and some who can't be, and some of it's kind of optional, but, there's an actual deployment involved. That's what I'm thinking of when I think of the public health service.
And I'll just quick clarifying question. I think for Representative Story, what constitutes deployment for NOAA and the public health service? I guess that's really the crux of the question.
To the chair, I am wondering if we could have the permanent fund division staff answer that, because I think there are other things in this bill that have to do with determining residency. So I'd like to hear from them.
Director McKinnon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Director McKinnon here. Under the terms of deployment, if you give me 1 second, that comes from the Universal Code of Military Justice, being subject to that. This would also be subject to the 5-year rule as it exists today, the 72-hour rule, and the intent to return. So to the chairman's question, there would be other factors that would be considered if the legislature were to expand this definition.
I guess I just want to circle back to, I mean, do we know what constitutes deployment for the NOAA Commission Corps or Public Health Services? Representative Eastman or Story?
Yes. Well, there are definitions for, like, for example, I mean, you mentioned the Commission Corps. There are two different types of service. You have service at the, you know, hospital or clinic or institution facility that you work in. And if you are on the deployable list, then, you know, you have, some number of months away from your permanent, you know, duty station. So they, are very similar to the military in that respect. Not just the rank structure, but also sort of the expectation of some members of the Commission Corps to deploy. And I'm thinking whether it's NOAA or the Coast Guard or the Commission Corps, you know, those expectations are lined out on the federal side, and we would just borrow from the federal side.
And I guess if there's 231 people in the public health service who are affected by this, I would ask either of the offices sponsoring this kind of language if they can nail down sort of who those people are and what constitutes employment and deployment, excuse me.
this is certainly
very, very, very satisfying. We're creating more questions as we go, but it's all a learning process, I guess, in this Byzantine world of PFD eligibility. Representative Story.
Chair Christ Tompkins, I would be happy to look into that and get that back to you.
Thank you.
And the committee and the
likewise,
sponsor.
Okay, terrific. Well, we're creating homework as we go. If it's all right, we'll set aside amendment number 4 to that next step. And let's amendment number 5. Representative Vance, let's see if we can get through this one.
I move amendment number 5.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Vance.
This is just more clarification of eligibility of active duty members. Requiring the physical presence of the state for eligibility.
Representative McCurdy, any comment on amendment number 5?
No, I think this is clarifying things, so I appreciate amendment number 5.
This is a title amendment, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Tarr and then Representative Eastman.
Yeah, the only thing, Mr. Chairman, is I'm just noticing we could have a conforming language challenge, for example, if we were to adopt this amendment and then also adopt the prior amendment where I think it's changing from armed forces to uniform forces. So I don't know if we want to consider those two things.
Representative Vance.
We could allow the revisers the flexibility to make the adjustments.
Yeah. brief IDs.
Title, we could allow the revisers to make the change based upon the other amendments.
Yeah, so when we take final action on the bill, I'll make note about conforming changes so the drafters have that latitude. So I think in the moment that issue is sort of solved, provided that when we make the final action on the bill that language is included, and I'll make sure it won't be today, that's for sure, but that is included in the motion. Back to amendment number 5. Thank you, Representative Tarr, for highlighting that issue. Any additional questions for the sponsor?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and appreciate the Representative Tarr for making mention of the issue. Good catch there. I am not fully convinced. I understand the significance of this title change amendment. I know it adds language. I get that. I'm curious, is there anything that can be said about what inspired this particular amendment? Any particular concerns we're trying to address?
Representative Vance?
I will defer to the bill sponsor.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So in this title change, it's just we're talking about, in this case here, uniform services, and that's what it's about. Remember last year, it got into discussion of what about all these other different entities. We've had a little bit of that discussion there. And this bill, 142, is really talking about military, or if we change this to uniformed services only.
Director McKinnon, any comment on amendment number 5?
Mr. Chairman, Director McKinnon here. No comment from the division.
All right. Representative Story.
Yes, Chair Christ Tompkins. If we adopt amendment number 1 relating to education then we might need to expand the definition, wouldn't be as accurate.
Ms. Naumann, if you're with us, how would the prospect of adopting, say, amendment number 1 or Representative Eastman's, say, amendment number 2, which didn't pass, but let's just say it did, how would adoption of such amendments interact with adoption of a title change amendment as embodied in amendment number 5?
For the record, this is Emily Naumann with Legislative Legal Services. It's my understanding that this amendment is to tighten the title so that when the bill goes over to the other body, it takes an additional step to change the title. In other words, the title, narrowing the title, has the effect of sort of locking in procedurally what the bill can be about. To the extent that other amendments are adopted in the committee that are outside of this tighter title, as you discussed on the record before, with the committee's authority by allowing us to make conforming changes, we would change the title to be basically the same amount of tightness for the other topics adopted in the bill.
Thank you. And I guess that just highlights, as we consider these other amendments, we want to consider we're effectively broadening the title and whether we want to do that or not. Other questions on amendment number 5? I'm going to remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 5? Hearing none, amendment number 5 is adopted, and it's 5:01 p.m. So we will set aside House Bill 142, having made it through 2 of the 5 amendments that came up before us. Don't worry, Representative Wilson. This just gives you a taste of the amendment process here to come. 15 amendments for SB 182. Thank you, Representative McCarty. We'll bring this back soon and endeavor to get through the rest. So that takes us to the third and final item on today's agenda, which is SB 182 from Senator Wilson. This is a first hearing. There's some invited testimony today. I think we'll try to keep this in the 15 to 20 minute range, allowing for committee questions. But Senator Wilson, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. And go ahead and present the legislation.
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins. And for the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D. And with me today is Ms. Jasmine Martin, staff in my office. We just want to say thank you for all our dispatchers, as this week is National Public Safety Telecommunicators Week. And so thank you for scheduling this during their week, the Chairman. 911 is a service that we often take for granted. Whether you call one time or 1,000 calls, an operator must answer that call. 911 centers are essential linked for our emergency response system, but abuse of our 911 system is happening and it's currently an issue. These operators are genuine and incredibly hardworking. It's incredibly frustrating for them to repeatedly answer calls when no emergency exists. These calls severely impact public safety, emergency, and response by delaying responses to real emergencies. Dispatchers must place these callers, genuine callers, on hold that are dealing with real-life, life safety type emergencies to answer a call for the 100th time from another person who may not have an emergency. For example, a dispatcher may be required to place a parent of a choking child on hold to answer a repeat of calls from a harassing individual who is not in need of emergency services, delaying necessary life safety measures. SB 182 addresses this issue by making interference with emergency communications a crime. This bill makes it a crime to call 911 repeatedly with no new emergency, and the emergency dispatcher has instructed the caller to stop. It makes it a crime if the 911 to call 911 repetitively, knowing that there's no emergency, or to threaten an operator during a call, or to physically disrupt emergency communication systems. In the past, law enforcement has attempted to use other statutes such as harassment or false reporting or disorderly conduct to stop interference when these type of situations occur. Often these efforts are dismissed by prosecuting attorneys because of the ambiguity of the statutes. This bill has the support of many affected agencies around the state, including the Department of Public Safety, the Alaska Association of Police Chiefs, Anchorage Police Department, the Mat-Su Borough, and many other communities, Mr. Chair. With that, if you would like, we can have Ms. Martin here. We'll cover a brief sectional. And again, as you mentioned, there are some people that are online that can provide a little bit more details and real-life situations on how these type of situations have occurred in the past that have hindered situations.
Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So it's a two-section bill. The first section is all new language. And the second section is all new language. So the first section adds a new section to regarding interference with emergency communication to AS 1156, which are criminal laws and offenses against public administration. And so since it's all new language, I'm going to kind of break down each part of that section. So A, it establishes the crime of emergency interference with emergency communications. So if a person calls 911 to elicit a first responder response for a previously reported incident and they've been instructed to stop calling. So the 911 operator says, hey, we know about this emergency. You've called us before. Please stop calling. I'm trying to coordinate other things. Makes it a crime to repeatedly call 911 to try to get a 911 response when there is no emergency. 3, makes it a crime to threaten a 911 operator during a 911 call. And 4, makes it a crime to physically disrupt 911 infrastructure communications. And then this part B here clarifies that 4A does not apply to in-person communication, so it's not disrupting in-person communications, it's disrupting that physical infrastructure. C defines emergency communication center, and emergency communication worker, and these definitions are taken from NENA, which is the National Emergency Numbers Association's definitions. And then D just establishes what these crimes are. So it's a Class C felony if the interference results in death or serious physical harm of a person,
Otherwise, it's just a Class A misdemeanor. And then Section 2 just specifies this only applies to actions after the effect of this law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins, and welcome. Thank you. Seems important. Bill before us, I did have a question about a person who has a behavioral health or mental health issue, and if you'd considered that.
Yes, we have, and this was one of the reasons of this piece of legislation, because currently there's no way to get intervention for that individual. Hopefully we'll have the Crisis Now piece of legislation that's working its way through the body. But there's no other way. Otherwise, the police will continue to show up every single time someone calls. They have to answer that call. For example, and I don't see one of our testifiers online yet, but what happened last year during the 4th of July out in Big Lake, we had a drowning situation occur. And during that same time, we've had someone call, was it 84 times and that interfered with the communications and trying to get boaters and get search and rescue folks out there to search the sort of the grid area and to have people respond appropriately. So these situations do happen. They are real. And unfortunately, there's no way to have to get intervention for that person without having some type of law that they violated. Most likely they will go to a therapeutic court situation. Is if someone is in behavioral health crisis, our law enforcement officers are trained to handle those situations appropriately. But without them having deemed necessarily broken a law and having some type of statute that they feel more confident in providing someone or in having that initiation to stop that call, it's really difficult for them to seek the help that they need. And then that's our intention, is really to, if it is that type of situation, to give them an opportunity to be helped.
Follow up. Have you considered putting something when we talk about the penalties? Because I'd hate to see someone get a felony if they're having a mental health or behavioral health issue. And is there a way to, require a person to go to therapeutic court?
That is through the chair. I'm sorry. Representative Story, that is something that the courts and the prosecuting attorneys have to decide. We just want something to allow, and this is from, again, these communications agencies, they would like something that can immediately stop those calls from occurring right then and there, and there's nothing to stop that without officer intervening at that point in time to stop those calls. What happens on the inside of that is you need to have something that a prosecuting attorney's Department of Law could have something to continue that process down. So that's something that normally in the previous committee in the Senate State Affairs, we had testimony from the Department of Law saying that most likely these things will be pleaded down and would be pleaded out. But it's on a case-by-case basis depending on the situation that presents itself.
I've got Representative Vance in the queue. This is Representative Story's question actually brings to mind. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, and she would call the police incessantly in Mountain Lakes, New Jersey, because she wasn't in her right mind, basically, after my grandfather passed away. And I guess I'm just sort of playing that out with the language of this bill. Like, if she called police incessantly and there was another call that resulted in a serious physical injury or death of someone, would my grandmother be a Class C felon, technically, under the law of this? I mean, granted, nobody agrees that her calling the police incessantly is a good thing. Everybody thinks that's terrible, but I guess I just want to understand the criminalization happening.
Yeah, so for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So if you look at that section A2 on page 1, lines 12 and 13, I think is kind of what we're talking about right here. It says make repeated emergency communications knowing that there is no police or fire emergency. And so that's not a lawyer, so I'm going to be a little careful about what I'm saying here, but that's language that you put in there to put the onus on someone to prove that they knew that there was no emergency. So it's not just makes repeated emergency communications when there's no police fire emergency. It's knowing that there's no police or fire emergency.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I mean, I given that this is legal language and basically it's our job to really nail this, I wonder if we could maybe we can have a drafting attorney and or criminal division, OPA PD, maybe sort of cross-reference this to make sure that we're achieving the intent with that current language, that that sort of achieves what you described. Effectively, how would a court of law or a prosecutor interpret sort of knowingly vis-a-vis someone not being mentally competent? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions kind of go along a similar path, not necessarily of being mentally aware, but on page 3, talking about the Class C felony and then the Class A misdemeanor. Obviously, this would be a new law. Is there going to be some type of communication with these repeat offenders that the action that they're taking is now going to be against the law? And the second question is, have you considered, first offense, second offense, and kind of a graduated thing that kind of gives people a notice, an opportunity to correct their behavior?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So your first question is, are they going to, do some public outreach on this law? I would assume not. Part of the bill and part of the intent of the legislation is just giving 911 dispatchers the ability to say what you're doing is illegal. Right now, they can't even say that. They can say, this is really frustrating, this is harmful, but it's not technically illegal. So I don't think Senator Wilson's intent is to have every single person that's ever called an emergency center more than once to be charged immediately, but it is to just give them the ability to say, please stop doing this, it's against the law. And then for your second question, the original language of the bill did have some escalation. So if you're convicted multiple times under this, it would ratchet up to a Class C felony, regardless of whether someone else was harmed. The Judiciary Committee and the other body was interested in taking that out just because they didn't necessarily think it rose to the seriousness of a Class C felony and didn't want to see people getting charged repeatedly with this and having it move up. So,
thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you. And we could move to invited testimony as well. Invited testimony online, and I might ask that sort of keep this brief in the 2 to maybe 3 minute range, just given the time, but we'll start with Commissioner Cockrell with Alaska Department of Public Safety. Commissioner, if you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm James Cockrell, Commissioner of Alaska Department of Public Safety. I'll make this really short. I know that we got some experts on the line, but generally I just want to say the Department of Public Safety certainly supports this important legislation because the consequences can be fatal if we have somebody continue to call 911, take away the operators to respond to an emergency at that moment. And we also have to provide the protection for our dispatchers that are highly stressed and dealing with normally belligerent people that call. Usually when they call multiple times, it's because they're not happy with the response of a law enforcement officer or how the call was handled. I understand the mental health issues, but there's sometimes they're so frequent in a very busy dispatch center that we have to take enforcement action. And this is one way to safeguard not only our dispatchers, but the public that we serve. Currently, the Alaska State Troopers have the Northern Dispatch Center out of Fairbanks. We partner with MATCOM in the Mathew Valley, and we partner with Connections to Rural. And in that total, we have well over 100,000 calls just generated by the Alaska State Trooper responses. And again, I see this as protecting our dispatchers, protecting the process of getting emergency services to the people that are in great need. And there's certainly some experts that dispatchers there that can relay the issues that they do have in responding to emergencies when we have somebody continue to call 911. And unless you have any questions, I'll just leave it at that. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Next in the invited testimony queue, we have Joel Butcher, President of Alaska Chapter of NENA and APCO up in Palmer. Mr. Butcher, if you can hear us, please put yourself on record and feel free to present your testimony.
Thank you. Joel Butcher, President of Alaska Chapter of APCO and NENA, the two professional organizations that represent communications personnel nationally and internationally. Please support this legislation. If I'm going to not repeat what Commissioner Cockerell had to say, our organization represents approximately 153 members in the state and over 380 emergency dispatch personnel across the various approximately 50 call centers in the state of Alaska. When these things happen, repeated calls, it ties up personnel, communication lines. Somebody spoke earlier to the repeat callers, and we have those common people that call in at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not intended to affect those. Like Jasmine stated earlier, we can have a tool for our dispatchers to say, hey, stop calling 911 unless there's something new to report. And if they continue to do so, then we can contact a law enforcement personnel to have them call the person and say, stop calling before I anticipate anybody goes out and makes an arrest. In terms of the Class C felony, serious injury or death, that's probably more directed to the person that decides to make a prank telephone call, say they're lost, search and rescue is ensued, you know, somebody's injured, a responder's injured in the course of searching for the person that's not lost. They can be charged with a felony for that. Then the FCC has certain regulations that involve transmissions of the airways, and this bill provides a statute other than general criminal mischief when somebody intentionally destroys communications equipment that our responders rely on, whether it's an antenna, a generator, shooting holes through a communication site. That type of thing can be criminally charged under this statute rather than just a criminal mischief statute. I think that there was one other point that I wanted to make. And our dispatchers are not allowed to just hang up the telephone call when somebody calls. We can provide audio of 82 telephone calls in a span of 5 or 6 hours if the committee would like to listen to strings of profanity. I don't think that you want to do that, but we need that tool to say, stop doing this. Oh, the other point was we've had in the recent past, people call 911 to report something to move law enforcement away from a particular area so they can commit a crime. And that's another reason for the statute to move forward. You have any questions? I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. I don't see any questions, but I think we would love to tap into your knowledge in a future hearing as well. Don't think this is a typo. Also have Jacob Butcher, same last name, no relation, also in the MATSU. So Jacob Butcher, if you're with us, please go ahead, put yourself on record and present your invited testimony.
Thank you. This is Jacob Butcher, communications manager with MATCOM Dispatch Center in South Central. I've been employed as a 911 telecommunicator for nearly 16 years now. Just wanted to bring some real life experience to this. As recently as this past July 4th, 2021 holiday, in which our 911 center was more or less attacked by two separate forms of interference with emergency communication. One form was through computerized call spoofing, which simulates false emergencies with the intent to obtain a large response for both law enforcement and EMS. These spoofing calls placed a total of 45 false reports within a 24-hour period, each one which needed an appropriate call processing, follow-up, and vetting to ensure the reported incident was false. These calls tied up resources from MATCOM, the Department of Public Safety, Anchorage Police, and Anchorage Fire Departments, among others. The second yet simultaneous issue that the center encountered was a member of the community who was upset with the way a previous case had been handled and chose to air their frustrations to the 911 dispatchers by dialing the emergency number over 80 times in one day, only to unleash a barrage of profane, insulting, and extremely vulgar expressions on the telecommunicator before hanging up. Concurrently with these calls being placed, the communication center staff was left attempting to sift through the false and harassing incoming calls to provide actual emergency assistance and response to a myriad of real-life emergencies, which included a report of drowning with ensuing water rescue efforts, two plane crashes, one of which involved two parents and their young child, four separate reports of wildfires, and one full structure fire. I'm simply asking that each member of the committee place themselves in the position of calling 911 seeking help for your loved ones and needing to be placed on hold for a false or harassing 911 call such as that. Most true emergencies are those where seconds count, and that is just not a sacrifice that we can afford at this point. I just wanted to speak from the real life experience and on the flip side of family members that may be calling 911 numerous times, put yourself in the position of your family member being the one needing help and not being able to reach the appropriate help in a timely manner due to these calls. I appreciate your help on the matter.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Given the time, I will set this bill aside, but thank you very much for the presentation, Senator Wilson and Ms. Martin, as well as the invited testifiers. And we've got this bill back up on Saturday. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Senator Wilson, we did get a definition in terms of, and this is state statute, AS 11.81900, and definitions about a person that acts knowingly with respect to a conduct and circumstances describing a provision of this law means offenses. The person is aware of the conduct and the nature of the circumstance exists. So basically, someone that is mentally ill that is unaware would not be found guilty under that definition of knowingly aware.
I really want to kind of hold fire here. But I like you, Representative Kaufman, have some questions too, but let's save it for Saturday if we can. Thank you, Senator Wilson, for the follow-up. And with that, at 5:24 p.m., we'll adjourn and we'll be back on Thursday.